Ladies and gentlemen, guys and gals, hey, welcome. I don't know where you're at, but today is a gorgeous day here in San Diego. So hopefully you're having the same kind of great day where you are in the world. Now, if you're new to the show, I'm glad you found it. What we do on this show is called Super Agents Live. I talk with top producing real estate agents, coaches, and authors. Now, this show is really a show about entrepreneurship, but through the lens of a real estate agent. So if you're new and you're a plumber, pie maker, or painter, you can learn from this show. So today's super agent is a guy named Bob Zachmeyer. Now, Bob, he's got a very interesting niche, however you want to say it. What he does is he goes out, and this niche works in slow markets and hot markets. And basically, I don't want to give it all away, but basically what he does is he feels that the problem in real estate today is the ability to get financing. So what he does is he finds somebody who wants to sell their house. He goes and they're going to sell it at market. He goes and gets a bunch of investors to buy, or, you know, one or multiple investors to purchase that house. They own it free and clear. And then he goes and finds somebody who is currently renting or locked out of the home purchasing market and puts them in there with a lease to own kind of a thing. Now, everybody wins in this. I mean, everybody wins. Bob wins. He gets paid three different times on a single transaction, number one. Number two, the person who wants to sell their house gets it sold. The investors get to invest in a very rock-solid asset. And then the person buying the house gets an opportunity to purchase a house, which they normally would not be able to. So very, very interesting. He's dominating his market. Nobody else is doing this. So I had him on the show to explain it to you guys. And hopefully, this may not be for everybody, but it's certainly an interesting thing to at least have in your back pocket when you come across, a situation like that. Now, if you don't know, we have a very strong Twitter tribe. The hashtag for this show, I haven't mentioned it in a while, but it's Unpack That Idea. Now, that's a big follow train. Go out and tweet and use that hashtag and you'll get followers. Secondarily, I want to tell you something that I'm doing. Now, all of you obviously know that that I'm putting agents on the radio. So there's historically only been one game in town. If you want to do radio advertising, there was this other guy, and now I've stepped in doing it. And I have, look, across the country, I'm actually starting to put agents on, and we're starting to see some success. So if you've been thinking about incorporating radio into your marketing platform, send me an email. Let's talk. Let's see if you're a good fit. Not everybody is. You have to have a team. Anyhow, okay. But listen, for you podcast lovers, again, I'm glad you found the show. But the name of this show, as I mentioned before, Super Agents Live. Now, if you are on iTunes and you see my show, a lot of people say, "Hey, man, I saw your show, but I had no idea what it was about, and I had no idea it was so valuable." And they listen to it and they're like, "Man, it's awesome." So I'm actually launching a new show, and it's going to be very simply named. It's going to be Real Estate Top Producers. Now, for you folks who have been found the show and have been listening to the show, it's the same content. I'm just taking my old interviews and I'm republishing them under another feed, because I believe there's lots of people out there that would love this show and find value in this show. But since the name is pretty generic, just Super Agents Live, they're like, "Oh, what is this?" I don't know. I didn't take that into account when I set it up. So, here's what I would love, man. We're going to be launching a show. It'll probably go live in a couple days, maybe over this weekend. You're listening to this on Friday. Here's what I'd love. I'd love for you to help the new show out and go and give it a rating and review. You've probably already heard the interviews, but it would really help that show out. And again, just I wanted to get into new and noteworthy. And I'm going to flood. It's going to be, because I have all the episodes already, I'm going to do for eight. You're on iTunes. You get into your new and new noteworthy, ready and able for only 8 weeks. So what I'm going to do is, historically, I've launched this show three times a week. I'm going to bang on that one 7 days a week. So I'm just going to, it's going to be a ton of episodes. So hopefully that'll help it. But okay, hey, enough about me. Let's get to the show. Let's get to Bob. Welcome to Super Agents Live.
This is the one place where you can come and hear the most successful people in real estate. You'll hear how these super agents built their businesses, how they stay productive, and how they stay motivated. Who am I? My name's Toby Salgado, and I made my first million in real estate.
Yeah.
And I'm your host for the next 30 minutes while we talk to yet another amazing real estate entrepreneur. Stay tuned.
Let's go. Yeah.
Cops out. Hey, Bob. Thanks for taking the time out today. Listen, I've given the audience a brief overview of your background, but maybe take a minute, tell us a little bit about yourself and your business.
Okay, sure, Toby. I am a real estate broker here in Tucson, Arizona. My wife and I both worked for Raytheon. We had a combined 42 years of work in engineering fields. We started our own brokerage in 2004 after retiring from Raytheon, and in the last 10 years, we've closed over 3,000 houses.
Unbelievable, man. I mean, I would want to do that math. So that is basically, so if you started in 2004, it's 2014 at the time of this recording. Quick math, that's 10 years. 3,000 divided by 10, you get 300 houses per year. That's amazing. Like what? Okay. So you're an engineer. You're a numbers guy. You're not necessarily a people person. How does a numbers guy go from like crunching stuff in the numbers in the back to all of a sudden putting up 300 transactions per year?
Well, the biggest thing is focusing on problems, and that's what engineering people kind of do, is they solve problems. So instead of advertising with a photo of myself, and that was the big baffling thing when I got out of engineering and into real estate, why would people put a picture of themselves on a sign? Who really cares? And it's more about how can you help these people than look at me. I have a real estate license. This is a photo of what I look like in high school.
So, okay.
Which is a joke, by the way.
No, it's not a joke. I'll tell you what. So we have – you're a little – I'm sure you're an older than me. But so are you on Twitter or no?
I am not on Twitter.
Okay, that doesn't matter. The point I'm going to make is we have a very, very strong Twitter tribe, and my Twitter handle for everybody in the audience, if you don't know, is just @SuperAgentsLive. But I see these people, and I see this picture, and a lot of times I will end up communicating with these people, maybe even get on the phone. I'm like, dude, how old are you? And they're like, I'm 45. I'm like, oh, your picture, your Twitter picture, and he's like, hey, I'm a realtor. Like, I never changed my picture. So that's not a joke. That's, like, real. People do that. So,
right.
So you realized – You know, as an engineer, you said, I solve problems. I want to do – obviously, you're doing real estate a little bit different way. What kind of problems did you solve that you saw in the market that was not being addressed by other agents?
Well, in slow markets, when houses aren't selling, you come up with a way to sell their homes that benefit everyone. And for instance, right now, the biggest challenge in the real estate industry is – the ability of people to get financing. So banks are turning down. I don't know if you saw this. For the month of June 2014, they turned down almost 50% of all loan applications. So you do your marketing, you go out and find buyers. Now half of all the people you found just got turned down by the bank and they can't buy a house. So for the last couple of years, I've actually been finding retired people who can't live on the 0.2% that the banks are paying them in interest. I'm getting them to finance the houses for the buyers that the banks turn down. So basically, I'm the only game in town for them to get a loan. And, you know, they drop everything to come meet with me. The people that are slightly upside down in their home still, because the market is coming back, but it's not all the way recovered here yet. So there are several people that are still upside down, roughly one-third of all people with mortgages. So if they're getting close, do you think a buyer with credit challenges would gladly pay a premium on a house, the high end of the range, to be able to get into it with financing? So when I offer financing, I get the retiree more money, 35 times more than the banks are paying them. I get the seller a higher price for their home, which enables them to sell when otherwise they couldn't, and I get the buyer a home that nobody else would let them have. And the good news is I get paid every step of the way for doing it, doing what I love to do and helping everybody else in the equation.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, that for the people who have cash out there, you're older, and you know, you get 35x, right? 35 times. I'll tell you. So here, I'm a bit of an investor. I'm holding one house today. Let me tell you how I did it. And I did seller financing. So I bought the house. I own it free and clear. I bought it in 2009. I got a great deal on it. So, so I put it up for sale. And this is 3 years ago I did this. This note is coming due. So I want to know how you structure yours and how people can, in other markets, kind of model what you've done. So here's what I did, Bob. Put it up for sale, found a bunch of people, and they couldn't, you know, a bunch of people could not qualify, right? The people who could qualify, they didn't want to pay me what I was asking for it and what it was worth. It happens to be a 5-acre ranch here in San Diego. So pretty rare that you get that kind of land. A few people said, okay, yeah, I'll pay you your asking price, but I have a very small down payment and I can't get financing. I filed for bankruptcy like 3 years ago. Now, I did through my due diligence. I looked at them. This particular people, the couple that I did the deal with, they had a successful business. So I knew their business was there. I knew they had revenue. So what I did, I said, listen, if I'm going to take the risk, I'm going to give you we're going to take what the standard rates or what people are saying that you can get from a bank, and I'm going to add 2 points to it. So at the time, it was 4.5 that you, like people were kind of the teaser rate you'd hear on commercials. So I said, hey, I'll finance it at 6.5%. And then what I did, right, to because I was very, very scared of writing a mortgage on a property and then they don't pay. And then like the whole eviction process is very difficult. So I wrote them a land contract, or basically sort of a fancy lease to own. But that allowed me to keep my name on the property. I made them pay for the property tax again, but the house was in my name. So they paid for the property tax, but I got the write-off because it's in my name. And that was part of the deal. So, and now they're, sure. Now their note's coming due and overall, I sold the house for like $390. And I've made, in that 3 years, I made, about $75,000 purely in interest. For me, like the sales price, right, instead of 390 was at the top of the market, I fundamentally got, right, 460 for it.
Sure.
So how do you...
And what would you have done with the money? I mean, if you didn't have it earning you, you know, 6.5%, what would you have done with the money that would have earned that much?
Well, you know what I would have done? You're saying if somebody would have been able to finance it and me just sell it outright, is that what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah. So I was flipping houses at the time, and there was lots of other deals. So I would have taken that cash and bought another place, I would have that money would have made me at least that $75,000, probably more. But again, that's assuming I can find another deal and all that stuff.
Sure.
But
there's no sweat equity in mailbox money.
You just go
to the mailbox, get your check, and put it in the bank.
Yeah. Well. So that's certainly interesting. So tell me how you structured that and. Because you get paid, you get paid three times, right? So you get paid from helping the buyer or the seller sell, right? So that's your 3% there. You're double ending the deals, number one, it sounds like. And then,
right. And then, just so you know, if I, without price fixing and quoting a commission, if I sell and bring financing to the table, I do get a higher commission than what might be standard for your area.
And
on all these sales, I mean, basically, I have the buyer and I have the seller, so it's pretty much a double-sided sale on every one.
That's amazing, dude. So why is nobody competing with you? And what market are you in, real quick, Bob? Tell everybody.
Tucson, Arizona.
Tucson. So you've been doing this for a while. How come nobody has said, hey, geez, Zach Meyer's putting up 300 transactions every month? Let me try to.
Not every month.
Oh no, I'm sorry. Every year. I apologize. I was every year. Why is it that nobody has stepped up and modeled what you're doing?
Most people can't figure out what I'm doing, and there's two different programs I have. One is bringing in the retirees, and basically just for nice even math, let's just say that you have a property at $100,000. That would be the FHA appraised value of the property. So then I sell it to someone for $115,000, and the buyer, let's just say they have $15,000 cash down, and then I will structure the loan in two notes, a first and a second, because these retirees, I take this very seriously, these retired people don't have the ability to work anymore and earn more money. This is their last hurrah, and I don't want to have their money at risk. So, I mean, anything is a risk, obviously, but I don't want to risk very much. So what I would have them do is give a, like a 70 to 75% loan to value of the $100,000 conservative market value. So in this case, that would be, say, $75,000. So now the seller of that home got the $15,000 down from the buyer, plus $75,000 from somebody like my mother, who's 80 years old, and now she's getting a 7% first mortgage payment instead of 0.2 at the bank.
Right.
So, you know, when she goes to the grocery store, instead of getting one bag of groceries, she's getting 35 for the same amount of money, basically, because I just got her 35 times more income.
Yep.
So now the seller of that home got $90,000, 15 in down payment and 75 in first mortgage funded by someone else. So that means that they only left $10,000 of equity, of their own equity in that sale, but the sale price was 115, they only got 90. That means that there's $25,000 left on a second mortgage.
And then
so that second mortgage would pay on the face value of $25,000, it pays 8%. So just simple interest is $2,000 a year on a $10,000 investment. That's 20% return.
It's amazing, man. So and then so you go out and find somebody else to put them in. So you put the old people in the comfortable first position, and then you put the second is a little bit more high risk. So who do you put in the second position?
Well, if the seller doesn't want to carry the second, I have a line of investors who typically buy that second loan between 50 and 60 cents on the dollar. So in this case, let's just say you had a seller that didn't want to carry the $25,000 note, and I found somebody to step in and take it for half price. They're paying 12.5. The seller already got 90. Now they're getting 102.5, which is $2,500 more than market value, and they didn't have to carry anything. The second mortgage investor is happier than a clam because now they have a loan that they paid 12.5 for that's got an 8% interest rate. They're making 16% on their money. And plus, at some point when that loan pays off, let's just say it's 5 years when the people either refi or sell, now the investor is going to be paid back $25,000 instead of the $12,500 that they paid. So they get another $12,500 profit.
What?
Which, when divided over a five-year period, is another $2,500 a year in profit.
Wait, run that last piece by me again. I maybe zoned out. I was writing some stuff down.
Okay, so the face value of the loan is $25,000.
Yep.
And it's the interest rate on that loan is 8%.
Yep.
So the investor bought the loan at half price.
Oh, that's
so
right.
So basically, for their money, they're really getting 16%, even though the buyer's only paying 8. It's because they bought the loan for half price.
That's right. They buy 50-60 cents on the dollar.
Right. And so far, we're just talking 16% interest. We haven't talked about the other half of the price that has been. You know, you have a loan worth $25,000. At some day when they refi or sell, it's going to be paid off.
Yep.
And that extra $12,500 is going to come into play.
Yep.
So, you know, if the investor invested $12,500 and the person pays the loan off and they made an extra $12,500, that's 100% return on the money plus the 16% you've been getting every year.
Wow.
It's a smoking good investment.
That is amazing, man. By the way, we should talk after offline, man. I would love to be take part in purchasing some of that second. So, you know what would be really cool, like just thinking about your business, Bob, is right. So, you're double ending the deal for the most part, and you know I don't know what all the other moving parts where you make money because you make money all through it. I don't know where, but it would be really cool for you, right, to just reinvest because you retired from Raytheon. You don't need the money, but it would be really cool for you to take your – or somebody out there who wants to model you, take your commission, apply it towards that second position that you're going to buy for 50 cents on the dollar, you know, right? And whatever that is, I don't know if at some point your commission would equal that 12 grand, for example. Would it be
sure.
Would it be about that amount?
Well, in this particular deal, let's just say that I made $15,000 sale. If I made a 7% commission, that would be like $8,000. if it was higher than that or low, you know, it wouldn't quite come out to the whole thing, but basically if you bought the second yourself, you would be within, you know, you basically buy something that pays, well, you can get it for about $4,000,
yep.
A note that has a face value of 25, plus
right.
A little bit of sweat equity of your commission. But honestly, I've never purchased one of those from my client because my fiduciary duty is to do what's best for them, not what's best for me. So I fund it with outside money. I would love to participate in some of these.
Yeah.
And so what I'm actually doing is I'm training agents in other states and other areas to do this as well, and then I can participate in their sales. But I just kind of take the high road as far as participating in my own.
Got it. Yeah, you don't need the money. I'm just saying, like, you know, for somebody out there, I mean, it would, if I was in your shoes, for me personally, I wouldn't see, you know, as long as I did the numbers correctly and I think I would cover my fiduciary duty but that would be amazing, right? You pay $4,000, I fund it $4,000 out of my pocket and I've done a little work putting everybody together, but now I have this thing that's going to pay me 16% and it's got a $25,000 face value. So, and here's the other win, it seems like, and I don't know how often this happens, but let's say the person that you put in there defaulted, right? So the grandma put 75 grand of her money in there on a deal that is worth 115, right? Let's say that somebody paid for
right.
3 years, the house appreciates, and then somebody defaults, right? They, whatever happens, they get, you know, death, divorce, disease, and then all of a sudden you have to redo this process with someone else, but now the house is worth 150, you know, amazing. That's you know, speaking of, you know, so Gary Keller, right, leads listing leverage. This is true leverage. I love this, man. I've never had somebody come on the show and talk about this sort of thing.
Well, awesome. And the thing about the retired person that now, in your example, if the home is now worth 150, then that loan is at 75, but it's been paid down slightly just from the regular mortgage payment. So that, because the second behind it is large, you know, enough, the second is going to do the foreclosing if it needs to happen, and they will make the payments to that first in order to take control of the foreclosure sale. So the first is in a very secure position, and worst case scenario, it costs roughly $2,500 to foreclose. But just the reason I want to see significant skin in the game from the buyer is, you know, they're basically put down a whole bunch of money that they don't want to lose. And now, you know, we send every one of these to a lender, a licensed loan originator, that checks their credit, does a Dodd-Frank compliance form to make sure that they have the ability to pay. So, I mean, it's all, you know, on the up and up that we're not putting people in that have a tendency to fail. And honestly, the people we're finding aren't deadbeats that are late on their cable bill. A lot of them are self-employed business owners who can't get a loan right now.
Right.
It's people who have just recently changed jobs and they haven't been on their job for 2 years. It's people that had a foreclosure or short sale, and now as of August 16th, it takes 7 years to get rid of a short sale if you're putting down less than 10%, and 4 years if you're putting down more than 10%. Those rules were just, you know, on the 15th of August, it was 2 years that you could get a loan after a short sale, and now the minimum is 4. So you got all these people that have been like tapping their foot waiting, and the bar just got pushed 2 years down the line from them. So this is a huge, huge opportunity for people to market to all the challenged buyers. And I have a team of 5 real estate agents in my company. My wife and I own it, and my brother works with us. So I have 2 other agents besides my brother and my wife. And we've gotten over 3,000 buyer calls on seller financed advertising in the last 12 months.
Wow. By the way, I this interview and what the content that you're giving us, Bob, is very unexpected to me. I'm very, very excited to dig into it. But and I want to talk about some of the market. Do you know who Steve Harney is, by the way? Steve Harney is a very, very big name.
I don't believe so.
Anyhow, it doesn't matter. He's a very, very smart guy. I've had him on the show, and you remind me of him. So I want to get into some of the same stuff that I covered with him. But so let's talk about the market in general. Before we get there, so let's say somebody, I'm in San Diego. So let's say I reach out to you and I say, hey, Bob, you know what? Show me how to do what you do. Or somebody is, you're in Tucson, you know, somebody in upstate New York or somebody in Northern Cal or whatever. Is there certain markets where this will work and others where it won't work. And again, I'm in San Diego. The market's really hot here. Is it, would it not work in an environment like this?
It will work. I mean, it's the challenge in San Diego is the house prices are so high. Mm. Finding someone to finance a loan at 75% on a $600,000 home, that's pretty, to find somebody that's got $400,000 laying around to put in a first mortgage is a pretty good challenge.
Yeah, but couldn't not to cut you off, but couldn't you just, form a pool, right? So create an LLC. An LLC can have, I think, 35 members, and then, and spread that $700,000 around 10 people or 15 people or whatever, and then whatever you put in, right, is you get proportionally back.
Right, and you would want to make your LLC in a state like Arizona, where there's a one-time filing fee of $35 and you're done, not a place like California where it's $2,000 to open an LLC and then $800 a year to keep it open.
Yeah. I didn't know that, man.
But definitely you could do that. That's definitely a very good way to do it to minimize the risk. But the now you're starting to get into securities and exchange rules where you have to have certified investors and they have to have a proper disclosure about the chance of losing and. There's definitely some laws that I don't want to go into, but let me just kind of tell you a different version of the plan that would work extremely well and is working extremely well in California right now.
Okay.
How many people do you think, Toby, went out and refinanced their house when the rates dropped?
A ton. Everybody, if you
everybody
could.
Everybody that could.
Yeah.
Right. So now the life-changing I'm getting married, I'm getting divorced, I had another baby, somebody died. I mean, those are the job changed, I got relocated, I got laid off. Those are the reasons why people sell. They're all still happening at the same rate. But why would you want to go pay off a loan that you can't even get anymore? If you've got a 3.5% mortgage or a 3.25% mortgage, why would you go pay that off? What if you let someone else use that loan for the next couple of years while they're fixing their credit? And so what I've been doing is just writing up real estate contracts that have a closing date 2 to 5 years out.
Okay.
And I'll just give you a quick example. I had a very close friend here that got transferred out of state. They had a $430,000 home that they were about $40,000 upside down on. I sold the home to a insurance salesman. He makes six figures a year. But he couldn't get a loan on his own because he had just recently changed companies. So that loan, these people had a 3.5% mortgage. We wrote up the payment as if it was a 5.5% on today's market value. And so he's paying them basically 2% a year on the bank's money. So his loan is $430. 2% a year means they're making $8,600 a year on the bank's money. And we wrote it up for a 2-year close. So that's $17,200 that will be paid off just in premium charged on the bank's interest. And then the principal on that loan is $930 a month being paid off. When you multiply that times 24 months, it's another $23,000 that got paid off just from making the payment each month. So when you add the $23,000 that got paid off in principal to the $17,000 that they made on premium, they just offset the $40,000 deficit, and we just fixed a short sale for $40,000 just by waiting to close.
Hold on, man. You lost me there, and I'm actually okay with math. So you have because I have my audience out there, and they're driving in cars or they're walking their dog. So
sure.
You have a property that's $430,000. It's upside down $40,000. So the real market value is $390,000. They had a loan. The original people had a loan for 3.5, and now enters this insurance guy. So he's making a bunch of money. And so tell me, like, just to make it easy, did the insurance guy move into the house? I don't know how this.
He moved in early. We do an occupy before close addendum to the contract, just like if someone's wire didn't make it on time and you let them move in a few days early. He moved in early, and basically is paying a occupancy fee by the day to live in that house.
And that occupancy fee equals their payment, right? Well, let's say it's $1,000. Their payment on the 430 at 3.5 is $1,000, let's just say. And he's paying $1,250. He's paying a 2-point premium.
And he's paying a premium over and above what their payment is, yes. And then the taxes are a pass-through. The if there's a homeowners association, insurance, all that stuff is a pass-through. Whatever it is, if it goes up, the buyer assumes the higher amount. So in California, you have to do it in two contracts. We do it with one here, but you would do a lease contract for 2 years and a purchase contract that doesn't close, you know, until 2 years. But that's how a real estate agent can be paid now, is for putting someone in the lease, and then they can be paid again for having the sale go through.
Interesting. So the original people that own the house that were $40,000 upside down, they win in two ways. They win because they're making the 2% premium, and they win because somebody else is going to cover the $40,000 that they were upside down on.
Correct.
And then how does the insurance guy, how does he win in this scenario?
He locked in his price. He saved his place in line. That house can't go up in value. I mean, it's appreciating. It's definitely appreciated. I did this last August, so we're already a year into it. And the house has gone up in value. He locked in his price last year. So he saved his place in line, basically. And he's getting to live in the house of his dreams now, rather than waiting until his credit will allow him to get a loan. And, you know, he's getting the same price. We sold it to him for the market value.
Yeah.
Without any markup.
So these people had a 30-year fixed at 3.5. Now, he's going to have to at some point refinance it anyway, right? I mean, or
sure.
No. Okay, yeah. So
the whole idea is we, again, send the people to a lender, find out when they would be able to qualify. The down payment and closing costs that they're going to need on that loan is escrowed every single month. So if we have 24 months, we take the down payment money plus the amount of that they're going to need total, and we divide it by 24, and they're putting that much a month into escrow. So at the end of the contract, it's not being held by the seller. It's being held by the title company as their down payment.
Mm.
There's a paper trail that it came from them. And so there's no, oh, gee, I forgot to save at the end of the transaction. It's just, hey, come on in, sign some papers. Let's put the house in your name now.
Interesting, man. Wow.
You just got to be creative to sell homes in this environment.
Yeah, so it's funny because so when did you – because you started in 2004, right? You came from Raytheon.
I became an agent in 2000. My wife retired in 2004, and we started our brokerage right after she quit.
Okay, and 2004 was a great year. 2005 was a great year. 2006 was a great year. 2007 started to get sketchy. 2008, the world melts. How did you transition – from go times 04, 05, 06 to what we saw in 07 and then what we for sure felt in 08?
Well, when I track the market. That's the engineering background that I have. I watch numbers like crazy. A market is a component of supply and demand. So I track the available supply every month. I track the demand. I track the number of price reductions. I track the days on market. And you can see when you track numbers, you get trends. You get seasonal trends. You get cycle trends. But you can see things happening far below before anybody else realizes that those things are even going on. So one day in 2007, actually late 06, it's all the houses stopped selling. And you started to see price reductions. And the big aha for me came when I actually called one of my clients who had a property listed and said, hey, the house down the street just had a price reduction, $20,000 less than you're asking. And it's the same exact floor plan on the same street. And that's where we got a problem coming, because the seller said, I would have to bring money to closing in order to sell at that point. So that's where I said, the only people who are going to be able to sell in this market are the banks that are foreclosing on these people. So I started doing research on how to, get in with foreclosure banks. I mean, who knew? And I found applications online. I'd go fill them out, and, of course, that never went anywhere. So I just – the five-star conference was coming up in Dallas, Texas, and I bought a plane ticket and paid to go to the conference. I jumped on the plane, and I came back with Freddie Mac. And the next conference I heard about, I went to and came back with another one. And I basically had a track record for over 3 years of going to a conference and coming back with a new bank each time. And I was hitting 20, 25 conferences a year. And, I mean, I was a road junkie. I was spending $40,000 a year on hotel rooms and conference fees. But we actually, in the worst, you know, year, in 2011, we ended up selling 641 houses.
Oh, my word. That is crazy, man. So, I mean, look, there's so much to dig in here, Bob. I had no idea. I had no idea when I first met you that you were going to be, like, this kind of wealth of knowledge. So let's talk about the market real quick. So, historically, you know, you do a short sale and 2 years later you could buy a house. Now, what you just told me earlier, you said that they've moved the bar from 2 to 4. Now, and I want to say something else. I know I'm talking a lot here, but the Credit Forgiveness Act, right? So if you do a short sale, if you, you know, you will get a 1099-C from the bank. So, and whatever the deficiency that the bank wrote off, all of a sudden they say, hey, you owe taxes on it. Now, there's been this Debt Forgiveness Act that has been extended so far in 2014. That has not been extended. What is going to happen, you know, with the moving of the bar from 2 to 4 years on short sales, coupled with if this Debt Forgiveness Act does not get renewed?
I don't believe it will be renewed. And I think as people get closer, there's two things that are happening. The market is improving. Prices are going back up. So that's, in a way, fixing the people that are still paying. And the majority of people who are upside down are still current on their mortgage. There's, you know, not that less than 3% of the loans in this country are late. So, you know, I think that over time, if it gets close, when we were in this death spiral and prices were falling and falling and falling, day it was actually quite common that you could come home from work and your house lost more money than you made. Well, now it's turned around where, you know, prices are improving again. And now people, when hope is back, they can wait it out. But the other thing is when you offer them, hey, if you're upside down, how would you like to get out of your home without destroying your credit? That's a selling proposition that I offer to buyers in my radio commercials and signs. And so I get a lot of my leads that way, and I actually can, with my programs, fix short sales.
Yeah, with your right.
So it's a huge opportunity.
So a minute ago, and again, you were talking about this Debt Forgiveness Act. So, you know, it is a way that, you know, for people to, you know, if you're underwater, it's kind of a get out of jail free card a little bit because you can get out and not owe taxes. Do you believe that shouldn't have existed? Is that what you're saying to me?
No, especially for the people who refinanced, treated their house like a piggy bank. If they took money out against the equity of that home, that was not a taxable event because the home didn't sell. So if you took money out and now you're selling it short, I totally believe you should pay taxes on that because you took the money. I mean, now if you bought a home as your primary residence, didn't piggy bank it and take out a loan against it, and then you've lost your home, that I think should be looked at in a different light. But I'm, you know, the day I start making my business depend on government decisions is the day I go out of business.
Right, for sure. But and I just, you know, I just like to look at, you know, forecasts. But again, you know, in 2013, that law sunsetted in 2012, and then Q4, I believe, in 2013, they
renewed it and made it retroactive back.
Retroactive, and we'll see if that happens again in 2014. Yeah, that's interesting. So what, again, going back to the short sale, moving the bar from 2 years to 4 years, I mean, isn't that, right, everything that you mentioned earlier, everything's about supply and demand. Now, if you move the bar, right, if you did a short sale and before you could buy a house in 2, and now it's going to be 4, aren't you messing with the demand side of the equation a little bit?
Well, the demand is the demand for a home, again, is job-related, relationship-related, or family size-related. So either you have more or less in your family, a job change or a promotion, demotion, or a marriage or a divorce where you're merging families or breaking them apart. But, you know, those things are still happening. So the people have not been able to act because of how much they owed in the past. So you have some markets like your market that's basically recovered all of the equity lost, and now you've freed all the people who couldn't sell for the last 4 years. You freed them all at the same time. So basically now I think you're going to see a surge, and you're already seeing it in inventory coming up because all of a sudden everybody can sell. So we have the government stepping in and artificially retarding the recovery of the – and this is just one thing. I mean, this was August 16th when in one day they took a person from 2 years to 4 years on a short sale. What about the change in the ability to repay, where they said that a qualified mortgage now is 45 – it went from 45% debt-to-income ratio to 43%. That 2%, I've seen different numbers, between 5 and 15% of the buyers that took out of the market just by changing that by 2%. But the biggest, scariest thing that we have in this real estate market right now is college kids graduating with student loan debt. Their student loan debt is actually pushing them into a place where they can't get a house. And the National Association of Realtors said that a normal real estate market has 40% first-time home buyers. Thus far in 2014, we have averaged 29% first-time home buyers. So, that's a 27.5% drop in first-time home buyers. And that's what starts the food chain. I mean, if somebody doesn't buy the lowest-end house, that person can't move to the next one and the next one and the next one. So you talk about a threat to the real estate market. If you don't do something to alleviate this college debt, I mean, the wages that kids – and it's all job-related – the wages that kids out of college are getting is 10% lower than it was 15 years ago, but college tuition on the last 15 years has increased 6% a year. So when you look at the chart and you actually see it on a chart, it looks like the jaws of a shark. I mean, one's going straight up and the other one's going straight down. And the spread just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And first-time homebuyers, I think that's the biggest challenge for this market. And then the Dodd-Frank legislation came in and took out – a whole bunch of investors who would do private lending and put five-year balloons on. And now you can't do that anymore unless it's a one-time thing to get out of the house you have. I mean, there's every time the government, Ronald Reagan said it best, the 9 most feared words in the world are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Right, right. So but again, I want to go back because I really am curious about this. So I want to couple this short sale bar, and there's lots of stuff that you mentioned that I want to talk about, but okay, so 2%, when you you said so much, man. So when you mentioned 2% and that affected a pool of 5% of buyers, when I was saying demand, right? So when you can buy a house after 2 years after short sale, then you say, okay, no, it's 4 years. What kind of percent of buyers out there is that taking out of the market, right? And then what is that going to do to the prices or the number of sales? Am I asking that question wrong, Bob?
No, I get what you're saying, and honestly, it depends by year, because you have to go back and look at the data from CoreLogic of how many short sales there were in the country and how many foreclosures there were in the country, and then you can see when the people got foreclosed on or had a short sale when they would be eligible, and now that when they're pushing back. I mean, short sales have been on the decline. Here in September of 2011 was when our market here in Tucson, Arizona, bottomed. And at that point in time, only 40% of our sales were traditional real estate sales without a foreclosure or a short sale. We are now at almost 85% traditional sales.
Yep.
So there's very few short sales left. I mean, short sales are like a root canal. I mean, by the time the bank gives you an approval, you probably have equity in the property anyway.
Got it. Okay. All right. So let's talk about this, right? So you said earlier when you were talking about demand, you said, well, that, demand comes from, people getting married, having new kids, and jobs. Now, I want to get your take on this. So if you go back to 2012, everybody said, hey, listen, the housing market is not going to come back until unemployment bounces back. Now, we can look at the numbers from the current administration, and, it appears numbers-wise that jobs are getting better. Although those numbers, the increased numbers that we're seeing and the reduction in the unemployment rate is really being caused by more service-oriented jobs, right? Blue-collar, not even
– correct.
So how – unemployment – or employment has not come back. How are we seeing this housing market and unemployment being disjointed, right? You still don't have strong employment, but housing prices are normalizing.
Well, the reason for that is the interest rates. If you put the interest rates back at 2007 levels, you'd be paying 7.25% for and that's with an 800 credit score to get a mortgage. Well, we're still in the low fours. We're 3 points cheaper than that. So, you know, in a market like yours, where, you know, a home is say $600,000, 3% of that is what, $18,000 a year? That's $1,500 less a month in payment than it would have been for the same exact house back in 07. So, officially, I mean, jobs don't have to pay as much in order to keep the houses the same or the market back to the post-recession or pre-recession levels as long as interest rates stay low. But when the rates start to rise and everybody speculates they will, that's where you're going to find the problem, because you're absolutely right about jobs. You know, we're seeing all these, oh, look, we're back to, you know, pre-recession employment levels. Well, great, but what's the pay that those jobs are providing? And yep, it's nowhere near the same level. As I said, I just found a statistic yesterday online about the college kids, and that since the year 2000, the starting pay for a college graduate is down by 10%. And over the last 15 years, look at what expenses have done.
Right, yeah. I mean, look at gas, for example. So I want to talk about first-time homebuyers in a second. I want to get your take on my situation. So my situation is I own five houses. I own three of them free and clear, and two of them I had mortgages on. Now, the first house I bought, I kept that. That is at a 5.5, 30-year fixed. My where I live, I paid $1 million for this in 04. And look, before we get to, there's so many things that are tied to this. Okay, so you go out and buy a house. When you buy a house, you get a mortgage on it, and that is a non-recourse loan. And I think a lot of people don't understand this. That is a non-recourse loan. Now, what will happen to most people, and what did happen to me, I bought the house, and it was at, like, whatever mortgage, I forget what rate I had. But literally a month or so after I bought the house, my guy came back to me and said, "Hey, Toby, hey, let's refi. It's not going to cost you anything, and I can save you X amount per month." And I said, "Okay, well, why not, right?" But what happens when you refinance a house, that loan goes from a non-recourse loan to fully recourse. Okay, so that means that the banks wanted to, they can come after you. Now, so I tell people, right, if you don't have to refi, you're unclear about your future, don't refi, because, you know, right, without refinancing, it's a non-recourse loan. And at least I know this is in California. I don't know if it's across the nation. Now, when the guy refied me, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on recourse, non-recourse. When the guy refied me, he put me into a 10-year fixed at 5.25. Now, and he said, and I said, well, I want a 30-year fixed. I'm sorry, a 10-year ARM. I said that wrong. And he said, well, you know what? Hey, everybody, nobody stays in their house for 10 years, so that's fine. Let's do the 10-year ARM, and we'll refi you later. Now, unfortunately, again, I have cash. I can pay my house off. It's not smart to. But I'm now in this ARM. It's going to adjust, like, literally, like, next month. And I don't know, like, I can't refinance because I'm not a W-2 employee. What is going to happen to me, and what should I do in the near future or long-term future?
Well, depending upon what the rate that they're tied to, if it's to LIBOR, I mean, there's a chance your loan could actually go down in interest rate. I took a gamble on my personal home back in 2003, and I got an ARM for 5 years, and I was guaranteed to save $500 a month for 5 years, which is, you know, 60 months. So for the 30 grand guarantee, I thought, I'm going to get an ARM. Well, my ARM over the last 11 years has been cheaper than it was when I originated the loan, because it keeps adjusting lower. So I honestly don't believe that interest rates are going to change very much. They can't. It would absolutely just kill the housing market. It's very, very fragile, and but just all of the legislation and everything, that it just seems every time you turn around they're doing something different to protect, you know, the home buyer and homeowner. the appraisal management companies. I mean, all these things. So I really don't think the rate's going to get you. I'd be shocked. I would almost bet that it goes down.
Got it. Okay, cool. I mean, look, that makes me feel better. Okay, so let's talk about this first-time home buyers. You're saying that because there's a lack of first-time home buyers, typically it should be 40% entering the market. Today it's at 23%, and you attribute that to
29%.
I'm sorry. 29%.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are these millennials. Now NAR just came out with some stats, and they broke out the millennials, the Gen Xers, which is me, and then the boomers. And it was amazing that the millennials, even though everybody thought they're not buying houses, they were 31% of the sales. And it just said sales, not first time. But, and then Gen Xers were 30, and then boomers were the other 30. So very even across the board. What happens, Bob, if we don't normalize these first time home buyers, right? If it stays at 29 or potentially goes under, what happens to the world? What happens to real estate?
Well, the people in the move up buyers or the end of the line retirees who are downsizing, they're going to go put their homes on the market for sale, and there won't be the buyers to purchase them. That's going to have an oversupply of homes and an undersupply of buyers, which is going to force downward pressure on the market, and prices are going to fall. The only thing that's kept prices where they are right now is the interest rates.
So,
because, I mean, you're not a magician. If you don't make enough on your job to afford a home, you can't buy one.
Okay, so if I'm a real estate agent out there, and I'm, you know, dude, Bob, you are a guy. I mean, you're a super smart guy. I had no idea that I was going to have this kind of brain, you know, on the other end of the mic today. I would have prepared a little bit more. I didn't prepare anything. I just showed up. But if I'm an agent out there and I hear all the stuff you are saying and I go, man, Bob's a smart guy. I'm going to try to, I'm going to build my business. Maybe I shouldn't focus on the first-time homebuyer kind of market, right? And I'm not saying going after buyers, but that there's a dim – wherever you live, there's a first-time – the entry price for first-time homebuyers are kind of clustered, right? In here,
right.
That might be $350 to $450, right? In your market, it might be – I don't know what it is. So how should people build their business? Should they steer away from that price point and go, hey, you know what? I'm going to focus on where these boomers are downsizing, right? If they're going from a 4,000 square foot house, they're going to a 1,200 square foot house, but sort of in an upscale area. I mean, how can people use this data to help build their business?
Okay, well, first of all, I mean, you're paid as a percentage of sales price typically on your commission. So, you know, the higher the sale price, the more money you make for the same amount of work on a sale. But the key is to find the sweet spot where it's the highest price possible before you start having significant drop-offs. And in this downturn in the economy for 4 years, people were afraid of the economy. They couldn't get loans. So when they sold, they actually downsized rather than upsized. That created a big void in the middle, and especially at the high end. You're going to laugh at this, but we have currently in Tucson, Arizona, 125 homes listed for sale that are less than $100,000, and they are not getting offers. They're not selling. We have 208 that are less than 1.25. But the big number is we have almost, 161 this month, homes listed over $1 million. Last month, we sold 5 out of 161.
Total,
so
not you.
We're talking...
The market
no,
moved
no, this
by.
Is a total. The MLS, there's 6,000 real estate agents here, and there were a total of 5 homes sold over $1 million.
Wow.
Which is a high number. I mean, the last couple of years, it's been 1 or 2 a month. But we're running, you know, like a 2% absorption rate on those houses. 2% sell, 98% don't sell. When you get into the $800,000 homes, we're looking at an 8% absorption. When you get into $500,000, we're right around 12%. So only 12% are selling. 88% of the houses aren't selling. So there's definitely, you know, a problem. And if you're in a position where you have to sell, when only 8% of the houses are selling, how much of a price reduction do you have to do?
Yeah.
But the whole thing is, you know, who would buy that house? Is it a first-timer or a move-up buyer? It's the move-up buyer. So, you know, this is where if you put your creative hat on, you say, hey, you know what? If you buy my house, I'll buy yours. So would you rather have a mortgage on a $500,000 house or a $300,000 house? I mean, if you kept trading down to get that person out of their problem, you'd actually hit a point where that house would then be in a highly sought-after market and be able to sell it. So, I mean, it's way better than sitting there at $1 million and having 160 competitors and only five selling in a month. I mean, you could lower your price a couple hundred thousand and still not get an offer.
Right. Amazing. Wow, it seems like in Tucson, if you have 120, I don't want to get into the investment piece of it because my audience doesn't care about it, but 125 houses under 100 grand, I mean, it seems like, you know, the rents, it seems like that's rich for investment opportunity. I don't know if I'm just.
Right. The rents on a three bedroom home here run between $900 and $1,100 a month.
Got it.
So now, granted, a lot of those homes are on the market for a reason. Some of them are four bedroom and one bathroom. Some of them have been added on to two or three times in the floor plan. You have to walk through two bedrooms to get to the third.
Oh.
You know, it's just, you know, weird stuff like that. But it's very, very picked over. I mean, the number of, you know, homes in that price point for a city of 1 million people, you know, 125 homes under 100,000, our cost of living isn't anywhere close to the same as what yours is. I mean, property taxes here on a house like that are probably right around $1,000 a year.
Wow.
And insurance runs about 600. So, I mean, it's fairly inexpensive. But the biggest thing is as long as you're playing in a price point where the rent is cheaper than the payment, you could sell them all day long on seller finance.
Right.
I mean, sorry, the rent is more expensive than the payment. So if you buy this home from me, you're going to save $150 in rent.
Right.
You're going to pay off $75 in principal. You're going to get back in taxes from the mortgage interest and the property tax, probably another $115. And then throughout all of it, for the last 31 years, our prices here have appreciated at a 3.73. That's straight to today, you know, taking away the big boom and the big bust and everything. We're still at a 3.73 average. So when you factor that in for appreciation, you're looking at almost $400 a month in appreciation. When you add all that up, it actually ends up where some of these people who we sell a home to, even though we put a premium on it, they end up getting more in benefit from the house than they're paying for it.
Amazing. Well, listen,
so they're actually being paid to live there.
We have to start wrapping up here. It's been a fascinating conversation to me. What did I miss? What should people know that we just didn't cover? I mean, is there something that you'd go, man, this is one nugget that I would love to share with everybody, whether they're aspiring or, you know, they're already, you know, doing 50 or 100 transactions?
Sure. Well, the biggest thing is to, you know, just stay focused on the market and just keep your ear to the ground. What problems are people having out there? As long as you can stay in front of people to solve their problems and find a solution to fix what other people aren't fixing, that's the way to succeed. If you're interested in doing any of these kind of notes and things, I one time a year I do a training, and it's a charity event. I do it all for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. That is coming up here in Tucson. I hope it's okay to tell
you. Sure.
Your
oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in Tucson at the University Marriott. We are having a three-day event. This is where I take everything I've done for the last year, and I basically give it away to people. I got people flying in from all over the country. I had five from Montreal, Canada come in last year. But these little events, I put them on, and your check, you make it directly out to Make-A-Wish Foundation. If you want to see what I'm doing and get it for a cheap price, it's $299. Believe it or not, Toby, in the last – I started doing this in 2009. That little event has raised over $300,000 for Make-A-Wish here in Tucson.
That, and that's such a great organization. I love it. So Bob –
So that's so, – if you want to email, you can just send an email to bob@win3realty, W-I-N, the number 3, realty.com. And you know, that's probably the best thing. And then I actually built a little software program that I just to run these notes in less than a minute and just be able to have a buyer sheet, a seller sheet, everything that I'm going to be sharing at this year's conference.
Awesome. Well, hey, listen, I'm sure, you know, my audience is very interactive, so I'm sure that as soon as this airs, you're going to get a ton of emails. I wrap up always with two of the same questions. Let me pose them to you now. We have about 5 minutes left, and it's the first one is this. I'm an aspiring agent. I have $25. What book should I go buy today?
I have a book called Sold on Change that you can buy on Amazon for about $15. And it is a step-by-step of how we took our business from 6 sales a month to 60 sales a month. There's that one.
Okay.
But I think the best investment you could do is to take your money and go to Home Depot and buy some blank bandit signs and just get a big fat Sharpie and start writing seller finance, owner will carry, and cheaper than rent. Put them on the, you know, on listings, on places that are legal for you to put them in your, wherever you live. Those signs, for me, have generated 3,000 calls in the last 12 months.
Wow. And so people can do this without having inventory in the backside, and just, and then once you get these calls, you put these people in the database, and then
It's kind of a chicken and the egg kind of thing, which
right.
one came first.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't matter which one comes first. You need a buyer and a seller for every sale. The best way to find sellers is to have buyers, especially those that want to pay over market value for a home.
Got it. Okay, I mean, I love this, man. Okay, and then here's my last question, and I don't know if it'll make sense to you, but you know, do you have any personal habits that you feel have contributed to your success?
Yes, I wake up every morning and I don't look at my email and I don't answer my phone for 2 hours. I spend 2 hours every single morning on my business, not in my business.
Love it, love it. Hey, Bob Zachmeyer, thank you for coming on the show. It's been a wonderful 56 minutes. I'm glad that I found you. I'm glad I met you, and I'm glad you decided to come on. So everybody out there, you have Bob's email, bob@win3realty. If you've enjoyed this episode as much as I have, you know, reach out to him. Just, you know, even if you don't want to go to the conference, you know, just reach out to him and say thank you for sharing. So, Bob, I'll tell you now, thank you for sharing. Thank you for coming on.
Hey, not a problem, Toby. Thank you for having me.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.